Welcome to History Counts. The purpose of this series is to bring to you the true facts of history. History provides the roadmap for the future, and the future belongs to the people. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Welcome to History Counts. The name Mother Jones may be known by most people today only as the title of a progressive magazine. But Mother Jones was in fact a real person, perhaps the most important American woman of her generation. During the next half hour, we're going to discuss the life and work of this remarkable American with her biographer, Professor Elliot Gorn. We'll be right back with Professor Gorn after this short break. Our guest today is Professor Elliot Gorn, author of Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America. A graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, Professor Gorn received a Ph.D. in American Studies from Yale University. He's a professor of history at Brown University, where he specializes in the social and cultural history of the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries. He's currently writing a book about the American bank robber John Dillinger. Professor Gorn, thanks very much for being with us today. Mother Jones, well, why was she called the most dangerous woman in America?
Well, there is a story behind that title. She was in court. She was under a court injunction in West Virginia in 1903, and she had violated this injunction against striking. And as she sat in court, the prosecuting attorney pointed to her and said, "There, Your Honor, sits the most dangerous woman in America." He went on and says, "She crooks her little finger, and 10,000 contented men walk off the job." She was a labor organizer and in the news constantly back then, and she was very, very gifted at organizing workers into labor unions.
So she flourished in the late 1800s and the early 1900s?
She was active until about 1920 or so, and lived to 1930.
She came to labor organizing fairly late in her life. You say that the tragedy freed her for a life of commitment. What sort of tragedies did she experience?
It's really an amazing life, and it's also a hard life to uncover because she was really very quiet about much of it. She was a famine immigrant from Ireland. Her family came in the potato famine and the great hunger. She had been born and raised initially in Cork, Ireland. The family then came to Toronto, Canada. Probably her father came over in 1847, which in many ways was the worst year of the famine. Just terrible death in that period. And he was a working-class man, worked on the railroad in Canada. When she came of age, she went to the normal school, learned to be a teacher, and she also learned the skills of a seamstress. And then she started traveling, went to Monroe, Michigan, and taught in a convent, went to Chicago, worked there for a little while. And somehow, around 1861, she ended up in Memphis, Tennessee, on the eve of the Civil War, married a man who was an iron molder, a skilled tradesman, and they had a family. They had four children, and in 1867, a yellow fever epidemic killed all four children and her husband. She was left totally bereft. And again, more tragedy, moves back to Chicago, becomes a seamstress again, and in 1871 is burned out in the Great Chicago Fire. Her business is burned out, joins tens of thousands of people just fleeing the flames. So this sort of thing, this constant turmoil in her life, that's in a sense. I mean, I sometimes thought that I would use as an epigraph for the book the line from Chris Christopherson's "Me and Bobby McGee: Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." She truly was in that position.
She had a long relationship with the United Mine Workers, perhaps her most important relationship. Can you talk about the conditions that coal miners faced in the late 1800s, in Mother Jones's era?
It's hard to imagine. It's hard to go back to that time and imagine it. Coal miners earned in the neighborhood, on average, of something like $400 a year, which is very little money even in that era. Workers had trouble having consistent work, consistent pay. The mine owners were extremely authoritarian. Many of the mine workers lived in mining camps, homes provided by the mine companies themselves. The mine companies imposed all sorts of draconian regulations in terms of the conditions of life, the abrogation of free speech, the imposition of mine guards, of armed guards. Unions were, of course, completely forbidden. It was really a terrible life. And this is a lot of families working under these conditions. Mining was a job almost entirely for men only. But in this era, say from 1900 to the First World War, anywhere from roughly 500,000 to 750,000 men worked in the mines. That's a very significant part of the American labor force.
And the unionizing effort, the striking activity, was probably even more dangerous than working in the mine.
They used to say that a lot of organizers would go into a mining camp and would come out in a box. It was very, very dangerous work. It's captured a little bit. A way to get at it a little bit is John Sayles' wonderful film, Matewan. He did the work, he did the legwork, and really kind of captured what it was like to be a miner and an organizer in the mining camps in that area, in that era. Matewan, a town in West Virginia. The UMW, let me say, was the largest industrial union in America at that time, a union that organized across skill levels, all workers, not just particular skills. And this was in many ways the precedent for what became the great unions that developed in the 1930s and subsequently.
So this was really the seminal modern labor movement that she was becoming involved in.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good way to characterize the UMW.
Now, one of the first strikes that she became involved in was the Central Competitive Field Coal Mining Strike in western Pennsylvania in 1897. Can you talk about what she did in that strike?
Yeah, the Central Competitive Field is really a whole large area that extends from western Pennsylvania all the way out to Indiana and Illinois, which was very, very active mining country, in Ohio also, not quite into just bits of West Virginia. West Virginia would develop as mine country a little later for the most part. But this whole large area of the Middle West, It was very, very thick with mines, with small mines. And she became really in some ways the most important organizer for the United Mine Workers in these years, in the late 19th century. And her techniques were very, very interesting. They said most miners were men, but she didn't hesitate to organize their wives, their children, into what she called for the women, mop and broom brigades, women who would intimidate scabs, who would go to the mine operators, the mine owners themselves. She was very, very active in that sort of way. She would bring farmers, local farmers, in to support the workers, the farmers who realized that their fate was also tied to having workers in the area, workers among them whose lives were decent. She was very, very innovative in her organizing techniques.
One of the important themes of your biography is how she conflated the union family or the union organizing with family values. You say, quote, only a strong family of labor animated by maternal values countered capital's degradations.
That's something we've really lost today, I think. And this is not original with Mother Jones, but it's something that she could really embody and make real for people. Again, in this persona of Mother Jones, the Mary Harris, who marries and becomes Mary Jones and transforms herself into this figure, Mother Jones, the mother of the family of labor. And this idea that one's obligations exist beyond merely oneself or even one's family to a whole family of work and labor and a common life of those who labor with their hands.
One that brings to mind Cindy Sheehan, because you're thinking of the feminine power in confronting authority. And when she camps outside President Bush's ranch at Crawford and says, "Where is my son Casey? Why did he die?" And what does a man in authority do when confronted with such a woman?
It's a very interesting comparison, I think. A comparison for another reason. There's a kind of authority that's purchased by suffering, I think, in this. And that's really true of both Cindy Sheehan and Mother Jones, that those who suffer have a right to ask questions and to have those questions answered and to be pointed in their questions. And I think Cindy Sheehan understood that very clearly.
Mother Jones brought to her organizing very large rhetorical skills. Can you talk about her speech-making ability?
She was really, really legendary as a speech maker. Well, there's a you don't mind, I'd like to read a passage from a friend of hers was Upton Sinclair, the famous author of The Jungle.
Sure.
Who described the Chicago stockyards. Well, he also wrote a book about the great Colorado coal strike of 1913. And he described a character that he created who's Mother Jones. He doesn't call her that, but it's clearly Mother Jones. He wrote, "There broke out a storm of applause which swelled into a tumult as a little woman came forward on the platform. She was wrinkled and old, dressed in black, looking like somebody's grandmother. She was, in truth, the grandmother of hundreds of thousands of miners. Hearing her speak, you discovered the secret of her influence over these polyglot hordes. She had force, she had wit, above all, she had the fire of indignation. She was the walking wrath of God. She would tell endless stories about her adventures, about strikes she had led and speeches she had made, about interviews with presidents and governors and captains of industry, about jails and convict camps. All over the country she'd roamed, and wherever she went, the flame of protest had leaped up in the hearts of men. Her story was a veritable odyssey of revolt." That really is a very good description of Mother Jones, as so many people describe her this way, this galvanizing effect she has as a speaker.
And she was not afraid. She didn't mince words. One of the many great quotes in your biography is, quote, "When I see the mine owners go to hell, I will get coal and pile it up on them."
Yeah, she didn't mince words. That's really true. No, she was really quite a remarkable speaker, and very much self-taught at this, of course. She was always described as having a slight Irish brogue still in her voice. She was very, very funny also. In a speech she gave once, she was talking about the Congress of the United States, and she told her audience, I saw them last winter pass 3 railroad bills in 1 hour, and when labor cries for aid for these little ones, or children, they turn their backs and will not listen to her. I asked a man in prison once how he happened to get there. He'd stolen a pair of shoes. I told him that if he'd stolen a railroad, he could be a United States senator.
And that brings to mind Enron, doesn't it?
It does. It certainly does.
Yes.
I was just only going to say she is remarkably useful to think about today.
She did see the world too, in terms of class conflict too, didn't she? The world was divided into those who create wealth and those who own it.
Yes, she did. I mean, her vision was very much a vision of class. She was not. Again, she was not, you know, an extremely well-educated, Marxist theorist parsing ideas. That wasn't what she was about. But at bottom, she believed that the working class created wealth, and that others took it and appropriated it for themselves, and that the working class needed to get more of that wealth back somehow and to organize for itself.
She saw unionism as really critical and more important than electoral politics.
She did, though there were moments in her life, she went back and forth a little bit. Finally, unionism is the key. She finally does believe that workers have to organize for themselves and take control of their lives. She was an organizer for a while for the Socialist Party, and a friend of Eugene Debs and of Julius Whalen, who edited the Socialist newspaper, The Appeal to Reason, a tremendously popular magazine, I should say. It was a weekly. But she would organize for the socialists and give speeches across the country and cared very much about electoral politics and the possibility of change through the electoral system. And then finally would decide that, well, this is electoral politics or a very middle class reform or a way to change things, and that finally workers have to do this themselves. Her heart was in the union movement.
And she saw that as more important than things like, say, a prohibition or even women's suffrage. She saw that she seemed to focus on the labor movement.
Absolutely. Like, for example, Emma Goldman, she talked about women's suffrage as being not a real issue, that finally what mattered was organizing around the issue of class. That women's suffrage, not because she didn't think women deserved or should have the votes, but because this was finally not where the real conflict was. The real conflict was about who owned the means of production.
You talked about how she'd lost the most important things a person could lose, her husband, her children, her home. Is that why she seemed to have so much physical courage?
I think that's right. That's not the sort of thing you can prove, but I really believe that finally is what's important in her life. I think one of the lessons you take from a life like hers is her ability to take the horrible things that have happened to her, the things that break people. And I think actually the loss of her family, in some sense, probably did break her for years. She really just disappears in the 1880s. But somehow she takes those horrible things and transforms them and takes that despair and that rage and makes them into something, makes them into, motivates her, powers her out into the world to try to change the world for the better.
She wasn't afraid of jail, right? She wasn't afraid of the National Guard?
She was incarcerated several times and always said she could raise more hell in prison than out, and she did. She would find a way to, when she was in prison, for example, in Colorado during the Great Colorado Coal Strike, to get messages out from what she called the military Bastille. These counties of Colorado were under martial law. That was the excuse for imprisoning her. And, of course, needless to say, you know, the guards imprisoning this frail old woman, my God, she could die at any time. The response was just so tremendous from workers. If you go to the National Archives in Washington and read the letters that were pouring in to the Labor Department and the Justice Department, to the President and so on, they're just remarable. People saying, if any harm comes to the old woman, one man writes, I'm not too cowardly to carry a gun, you know, I mean, implying, you know, real retribution if anything happens to her.
How successful was she in her organizing efforts with the coal miners?
You know, there's no simple answer to that question. In one sense, very successful. Literally tens of thousands, maybe you could even say hundreds of thousands of workers who had not been organized were organized by the end of her life. The Central Competitive Field is an enormous area, again, with tens of thousands of workers, whole areas of West Virginia, Colorado, and Pennsylvania. Workers become organized in the union. The conditions of their lives improve measurably. Their pay, the safety, terribly dangerous job, the civil liberties, and so on. She's quite successful in that sense. She loses a lot of battles, too. There's no doubt about that. I think one of the ways you measure the success is not just by the campaigns won or lost, but also by her ability to keep certain issues in the public eye, child labor, for example. Even though her children's crusade to eliminate child labor, it doesn't succeed in doing that in 1903 during the children's crusade. But
can you talk about that? Does that come out of the Kensington Philadelphia mill strike?
Yes, yes.
Could you talk about that?
Sure. It's a larger textile strike in 1903, and again, she's very improvisational. You know, she doesn't go into the strike, the Kensington strike, which she is helping in. She doesn't go in with the idea of a march of the mill children, but it comes to her that, well, amongst these workers in the mills in Pennsylvania are many, many very young children, and that there is sympathy for the anti-child labor movement, and so she links the Kensington strike to the fact of child labor in the mills, and marches with several hundred children. The number gets cut down as the summer heat comes up, but marches with these children basically from Philadelphia all the way down into Pennsylvania, into New York, through New York City to Theodore Roosevelt's summer home at Sagamore Hill on Long Island, all the way talking about how what she wants is an audience with the President of the United States. Now, of course, she doesn't expect that he really will do that, and he's not available. But there was tremendous publicity against child labor in all of this. And
she gathered very large crowds in her way?
Very large crowds. And she would, again, she would say things to a crowd like she would put her hands on the shoulder of a small child whose hands had been broken in the mill, that sort of thing. In Princeton, New Jersey, she says this. She says, here's this child, that she's right in front of her, and she says, here's a textbook in economics. Not what the professors in Princeton are teaching, but this child right here. This tells us all we need to know about economics and what the economic system is doing to people.
So she saw that not child labor per se as the issue, but the abuse of children was an aspect of the abuse of all workers. Was that her?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That it's not simply about children. This is about, again, this is about what's happened to labor and how laborers have to organize to fight back.
You quote in your book a speech she gave, I believe, on that campaign where she denounces the, quote, cannibalistic plutocrats grinding out young lives beneath the wheels of gold.
Yeah, she went for what Mark Twain used to call the high style.
People don't speak like that. I'm thinking William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, and now you hear the people with their 30-second sound bites on TV, and they don't use this kind of rhetoric today.
It is a different world. Our patience for oratory is really not what it was. But she certainly was. She certainly could do that. And again, that particular passage you quote really is sort of the high style. But she could also be extremely funny and witty. She could have an audience just eating out of her hand. She was really quite remarkable. And again, you've got to remember, this is the 1910s, the 19-teens. This is a woman doing this under this guise of being old Mother Jones.
Well, one of the keys to understanding Mother Jones is the way she played at the edge of violence. The threat of force was magnified by her claims to protecting what was sacred, women, children, families.
Absolutely. There's a way in which she's always, there's always the possibility of violence. Look, if there's not the threat, at least the threat of force, of all of these workers who are angry, abused, put upon, of their striking, of strikes aren't always pleasant and courteous events. That's part of the power. And you have to remember, this is in a context in which the mine owners do not hesitate for a minute to bring force, initially to bring force.
And they could call upon the government, the force of the government, essentially, to act on behalf of their interests.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The National Guard troops are basically brought to bear to do the bidding of the mine owners. It's really not until the Great Depression, till the Franklin Roosevelt administration, that government troops and private troops are almost the same thing.
She was ahead of her time in one respect that surprised me in the book, to realize that she was involved in international workers' rights, and in particular in the Mexican revolution of the early 1900s. She was championing the cause of exiled Mexican leaders.
She certainly recognized that labor was becoming an international problem, that a considerable amount of mining and for that matter, smelting, metal processing was done along the border of the United States and Mexico, on both sides of the border, that workers were coming from Mexico, miners, and she was very, very much in favor of organizing Mexican laborers. She participated in one of the Pan American conferences. She was very, very active. She actually organized in Canada a little bit also.
So she saw, like, maybe she had the sense of global capital, that the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the Harrimans were moving their money to the neighboring countries and exporting their same anti-labor approach.
Yeah, it couldn't have been clearer in the case of Mexico. Mexico was enormous amounts of Mexican extractive industry were owned by the likes of Phelps Dodge and other American companies in this era. And people like Mother Jones, who were paying attention, knew this.
Now, the labor force has changed very much since she was organizing the United Mine Workers. Things like the deindustrialization of America, steel mills closing, and more movement to service jobs, white collar jobs. So, how would she operate in an environment like today?
That's a very good question. Mother Jones was not one to butt her head against a wall. She was not one to like. She did not like to lose just to be right. She would try to find a way to organize. The laws are so much more stacked against organizing laborers today, workers today, than they were really just a few decades ago. And really, the laws have changed, and it's much, much harder to organize American workers. I suppose she would, of course, try to be changing those laws. I imagine that Mother Jones, you know, she wore these antique dresses, and we like to think of her as in this kind of, you know, the sort of antique sort of way. But I don't think she thought of herself that way, and I don't think others thought of her quite that way. She would bring, look, what's a very, very modern technology of her era? Well, a Victrola. She would attract a crowd with a Victrola playing music at her speeches. I imagine she would use whatever she could to get the word out.
She was very resourceful, and she did self-consciously cultivate this image that she had, right? It was not an accident. She
Oh, not at all, yeah.
Knew what she was doing.
No, she was very, very deliberate. She the whole image of Mother Jones and the antique dresses and exaggerating her age, she told people she was older than she really was. It was a way of saying, especially to workers, look, if I, an old lady nearing 90 years old, can be out here where my life is being threatened, you can too. And she would say to workers that if they're too cowardly to be out on the line, to be organizing, to be striking, she would say, well, I can't believe that women would even live with you.
Do you see any people, any leaders today who seem to be carrying on in her tradition?
No, it is a different world. And it's the context has changed. The possibility of mass organizing seems so much more attenuated. I think you saw glimpses of it a year ago in some of the demonstrations in cities over the immigration issue. You saw it not in English but in Spanish, for example, with some of the leaders who sprang out of nowhere who were on the radio, or at least they sprang out of nowhere if your primary language is English. You know, these people were out there all the time. I think if we don't see it today, it's because we're looking in the wrong places. I don't think it happens in the same way in unions, for example. It's just there certainly are great union leaders today, but it's very, very hard, much harder than it was. I think we see it with move on a little bit. We saw it a couple of years ago anyway, with MoMA. I think we see it in a certain way with filmmakers like Michael Moore. I think we have to look for this ability to be out there in the public and getting the word out about issues in unexpected places.
How would you sum up her legacy?
How would I sum up her legacy? That's a hard question. Above all, I would say that this was someone whose voice we weren't supposed to hear, and she was heard loud and clear, and that came out of a commitment to ideas, but it also came out of a life of tragedy that she finally decided she would make into something constructive. She would not let it be merely a life that crushed her, but it would be a life that she converted into something truly constructive.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, Professor Gorn. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with Professor Elliot Gorn, author of Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America. I'll be back in a moment with some final thoughts.
You're listening to Ken McDermott Rowe's History Counts, where history comes alive.
Mother Jones is an emblem of democracy, for she shows that one person, however humble, can confront the most wealthy and politically powerful elements of our society and win. Mother Jones is also an emblem for the unique and unstoppable power of women, for it is women who can inspire ordinary men to fight for justice against hopeless odds, and it is women who can publicly shame corrupt leaders that betray their manhood by exploiting the weak. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.